Hello, folks. I'm John Myrie, and welcome to the Wisconsin Northland Outdoors. Well, folks, you know, we've seen a lot of changes out there on our waterways over the years, and one of the things we've been dealing with is AIS, or aquatic invasive species. And that can be anything from zebra mussels to several different types of weeds out there, and even more. Well, anyway, one of the things that we're going to talk about today on the podcast is how they control some of the weeds like Eurasian water milfoil. You know, there's several different methods. They've tried to control it, none of which have really worked all that well because the weeds just keep coming back, but they can at least keep it down a little bit. Well, one of the methods has been using chemicals on the water, and I had a chance to talk to Hayward Area Tournament bass fisherman Ken Melender, who's done a tremendous amount of research and digging into this as far as whether we really should be using chemicals on the waterway and whether it does some damage or harm to the fisheries out there and the other weeds in the lake. Well, anyway, Ken had a lot of good information and a lot of data to back what he's going to talk about up. Let's get right into that discussion we had with Ken about weed control on some of our lakes. On the podcast here, we've got Ken Melender from Hayward. Ken works at the Hayward Bait Shop in town and fishes a lot of big bass tournaments. Actually, you won a pretty big one. You're scheduled to fish the Nationals this year, right?
Yeah, I qualified second to the state of Wisconsin, so I'll be fishing the National BASS tournament in Grand Lake in November of this year.
That's down in Oklahoma, right?
Yeah, that's right where the Bassmasters Classic was just held.
You bet. Well, it'll be interesting, and I hope you do real good, bring a big trophy back here to Hayward. But what we're going to talk about today is our lakes up here in northern Wisconsin, and I imagine this holds true in a lot of places too besides northern Wisconsin. But, you know, we keep hearing this about invasive things. I mean, and there's a whole lot of different invasive things. There's weeds and there's things like zebra mussels. We don't have a lot of them around Hayward here. You don't want them because they really clear the water up, and they do a lot of, you can't hardly, you know, walk on the beach without, you know, scuffing your feet up from all the zebra mussels and some lakes. But weeds are what we have here, and Eurasian milfoil is one of the big ones that when people are trying to get rid of on some lakes up here.
Yeah, even though it's really good for the habitat for all fish species, and even crawdads use it quite often, but the thing of it becomes a hassle when it grows to the surface, and, you know, people don't like seeing that, and then the boats drive through it without going around it, and then they spread it in other areas of the lake, and that's why it gets a lot of attention.
Well, you know, and you're right there. Some lakes are worse than others. But when you said something about the fish out there, I mean, talk about Guntherville Lake. Well, that's Alabama, I think. That was a so-so bass lake years ago, and that's in the Tennessee River Valley thing. And that thing got both Eurasian milfoil in it, and I believe it's hydrilla. Both of them are what's called canopy weeds.
Yeah.
And now it's one of the best bass lakes in the country, isn't it?
Well, it helps supply a good food chain, you know, so all fish species can, you know, eat different size of food, you know, as they get older. And so actually, weeds act as a filtration for yard chemicals and stuff too, and then it helps balance the pH. If you do excess killing of weeds, it increases the phosphorus, you know, considerable. You know, just the septic system alone, conventional one, has a load of like 2.25 pounds of phosphorus that's dumped into the lake. You know, so, you know, having the extra weeds, you know, around the shoreline will help buffer the main lake water body.
You know, and talking about Eurasian milfoil specifically, and that's one of the, what I mentioned earlier, it's a canopy weed, which means most of the vegetation, the top of it is just under the surface, it's over the top. And when it comes to the surface, it creates a problem for boating and for getting through and things like that. But what the fish like about it, it's like being underneath a great big umbrella. You know, they're down there in them little stocks, and they can swim around, and they get a lot of shade. So, you know, when you're dealing with that, somehow we have to control it, basically, or try to control it. And there's a bunch of different ways they've tried to do that over the years. And I know the one we're going to talk about on the podcast here is use of chemicals on it. But there's a bunch of different ways that they've tried to eliminate it, and so far they really haven't been successful at it.
Oh, they keep dumping chemicals at it, and what they do is they just destroy the natural aquatic vegetation, and the milfoil is only left. And then there's the eelgrass, you know, there's very few chemicals to get rid of some of the grasses, and then you have, you know, eelgrass take over that really doesn't have a whole lot of environmental impact to the ecosystems.
Well, you know, the big one we want to talk about here, I know you want to talk about it, is the use of chemicals on the lakes, because we're starting to see some things that are not good when it comes to the fish out there.
Well, what got it all started, there's a lot of public knowledge, and EWG has done phenomenal studies on all kinds of chemicals. And then, you know, every state agency, their environmental pollution control agencies, from the federal down to the state, has been, their funding has been stopped. You know, back in the 80s, there was a big drive to try to clean up our water. And Minnesota was a really driving factor on trying to clean up the Minnesota River. And so they implemented a lot of laws to help protect the water quality, especially, you know, dump it's going all the way down to, you know, Louisiana.
I know you used to see sewage actually floating down the Mississippi River. It was really bad back, you know, 50 years ago.
Well, there's ramifications that are happening now coming forward on some companies that would just dump it right into our Great Lakes. You know, so some areas of the Great Lakes, you know, it's not really good as far as forever chemicals. So how this all got started. So many years ago, there was a couple dairy farms in Maine. So they come in there and they studied the milk to test it for PFAS, or forever chemicals. And it was appalling. It got to the point where on one of the farms, it was on record. And the one farm that was on record, that being the worst ever documented, is they were using septic waste from a water treatment plant 20 years prior to that. So they had to get rid of all the dairy cows, every one of their other farm animals, and they condemned the whole property. Two different farms in Maine, and what happened was like 400 and some wells were contaminated, unsafe to drink too. And so they went one step further. So they sent the grasses and other weeds and stuff. They sent them to a lab in Canada, and they found out that there were high concentrations of these forever chemicals in the plants growing on it. So not only were the cattle getting it from the groundwater, they were also eating it every day. And now Maine has warnings in regards, don't eat any deer or turkeys or any other wildlife anywhere around these two areas. So that started the whole ball going. And then EWG, Environmental Working Group of top scientists in a nonprofit organization, they've gone gangbusters on studying forever chemicals in our food, in our water. There had been investigative studies in regards to the EPA has fudged the books. So we put probably over 46 million pounds or gallons of chemicals in our food supply. So I spent a lot of time talking to Ken Bradbury. He's now retired. He was a senior hydrologist for the state of Wisconsin out of UW-Madison. And we talked at great length in regards to, you know, how are these chemicals getting into our aquifer. Aquifers, they supply people's wells. It pressurizes into lakes. I mean, I've been in Montana in 10,000 feet, and there's water coming out of the ground. So water comes in and out of a lake. It just doesn't come in. It also leaves it through depressions. In fact, with today's electronics, you can go to any lake and you can find where the springs are.
Well, you know, and we're hearing some stuff now lately about forever chemicals. They've been referred to one particular chemical, I think, and you mentioned it here, but there are more than one that stays in the system for a long time.
Well, you know, if you're going to go, so there's probably different groups of PFABs. I don't know what the Biden administration is doing. I think they're listing like 26 of them, that within 3 years, every public water supply and facility that provides water for 25 or more people, they have to have their water tested for forever chemicals.
Yeah. Well, what does this come back to when it comes to exotic plants? So I know one of the things they use is 2,4-D on them.
Yeah, that's what I've been told. So the state of Wisconsin, they have six approved aquatic herbicides to treat plant growth within a water. You know, some of it it's for like purple loosestrife, and then some of it's for subsurface, some of it's for algae. But 2,4-D, you know, it was indicated that it's for Eurasian milfoil, but studies have proven that it's not just targeting, it wipes out all plant growth. And then they go by half-life. It's a really corrosive acid-type product that can float, and it's very, very mobile. I mean, it goes in the water system, and there have been reports it can be in the water column over 186 days. And so when a fish or invertebrates or any other active organism within a lake gets in contact of that, it's devastating. In fact, last year during a local lake, it's like 5,000 acres and it's 24 and a half miles of shoreline. You know, they had little black buoys out there and they marked all the areas where they wanted to put this 2,4-D. Supposedly that's what I was told. And that, so I monitored tournament weigh-ins. And they put that chemical when the water temp was over 70 degrees, which makes it really susceptible to a strong thermocline. It's going to stay above that, being it's so mobile in the water column. And so there was like 65% of the fish had lesions on their body, anywhere the size of a quarter to half their bodies. All the way as deep as, you know, getting to their spinal column. So the first tournament, there was 19 boats team. And then the second one, there was, I think, 10 or 12 boats, two anglers, limits per. And then the last one was 25 boat team. And 65% of the smallmouth and largemouth that I visually seen with my own eyes were not going to make it. And out of all the bass weighed, 70% were smallmouth versus 30% largemouth. And consensus on talking to some of the anglers, the smallmouth are caught over 20 feet deep. So I do know that I have caught a lot of big smallmouth on this lake, and a lot of them are weed oriented. You know, all the directions and everything on these labels say, you know, just do it a little bit at a time, you know, so it gives time for the fish, you know, to move, and never do it on a windy day. But it says right on every label that I read here, very toxic to fish and invertebrates. So why would they put that right into a water body? You know, this particular Lakeshore Association got a $150,000 grant through the Water Department of the state. It, you know, I don't know how much they put in aquatic herbicides, but you go into contrast, the state of Minnesota, they give a grant for $400,000 total. That's it. So granted, there's different projects going on within the state, but Wisconsin gives $6.5 million.
Wow, that's a lot of money. And, you know, I know that really got you going when you start seeing all those fish with those open sores on them and deep sores. And you know, that's not a coincidence, I don't think, that happened and showed up after they applied this stuff on the lake. Because if those fish are under that milfoil and they put it over the top, I mean, they're going to be hit with it, I think.
Well, here's the strongest evidence. There was another tournament before they put it on there. There was zero evidence. So talking to... So this is a Lakeshore Association guy. He promises that he's never going to donate to him again. He took his family out there, young kids, and they caught a bunch of northerns, and they had to throw them all back. And I says, why do you have to throw them all back? So he told me what he visualized. And then guides have seen it on walleyes, too.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's not good, and it's... But, you know, the DNR supposedly has got this done some testing or something. Haven't they done some testing on it?
Yeah, there's a lake, you know, on the questionnaire on the spring hearing, you know, on, like, I think it's questionnaire 34. The DNR, you know, did some analysis on a lake, and the 2,4-D is just devastating to a lake. You know, I haven't researched what size of the lake or anything, but you can't continually put chemicals in a lake and expect to get strong results, because it just destroys the ecosystem. So you have a balance. You know, all life, regardless of it, if it's subsurface or surface, starts with bacteria. And then for an aqua system, you got to have zooplankton and phytoplankton, the minnows and everything. You know, for instance, you know, I took my brother out. He's from Montana, and I took him out to both Le Coudre and Grindstone. And you can't believe the size of the perch, the sunfish, and the crawdads that are living in like 27, 30 feet of water in the muck. So if all this chemicals during fall turnover falls to the bottom of the lake, so you have the lattice flies, you have the dragonflies. So dragonfly nymph lives in a muck life, and they're cannibalistic.
Yeah, Helger mites.
Yeah, and there's no set pattern on when they come up to the lake and subsurface and then hatch and then die a few days later. But one thing I have noticed on the lakes that put any type of chemical into the water, or even some of the smaller lakes that are susceptible to chemical through agricultural drain, the lattice flies. So I have a white and blue boat. Lattice flies just love it. It's kind of like a miniature dragonfly with white and black stripes. They're just all over bugging me, and it's like, boy, it's been a long time since I've seen one.
Yeah, well, you know, it changes everything out there, you know, and, you know, it's not just the control of the weeds, but we're seeing it from sometimes shoreline applications too.
Yeah, in fact, I went up to this one guy, he was spraying Roundup, you know, that's not good. I mean, there's lawsuits going all over in regards to, you know, people dying because of it. He's spraying at 2 feet to the lake with no gloves on, no mask, no nothing. So I was trying to give him some fluorine. Well, maybe you should read the label. Just unfold it and see the environmental hazards that can be. He just told me, you don't tell me what to do. And I go, hey, I'm just trying to maybe give you a few more years of your life.
Well, you know, there's a lot of things, you know, but yet, on the other hand, I can understand we need to control some of these weeds like Eurasian milfoil in some places. I mean, there are places where, you know, people want to control it and it's really not causing a problem, where you've got, you know, up against shoreline someplace and you've got open the main lake basin on a couple lakes I know of, and it's really not, you know, causing a problem that's created, you know, some good weed cover for fish. But there's also some lakes that are shallow, and I mentioned one of them earlier that, man, you get up on the north end of that lake, you can't hardly drive your boat through it because, you know, it's right to the surface and you're in 3, 4, 5 feet of water. In those situations, we need to figure out how to control it somehow, but there are other methods to control it as well as putting chemicals on.
Best thing ever is a weed harvester. People think that, well, the weed harvester, you're going to cut up the weeds and, you know, you're going to spread the weeds further. If you keep the chemicals out, like, weeds will grow wherever they grow naturally through seed dissipation and stuff. Like, for instance, coontail, it's a non-rooted plant. So the decaying weeds through fall turnover, it collects in certain areas of the lake. So if you can figure out, usually it's a pattern, because late fall, that's one of the best weeds that creates the most amount of oxygen for a fish, and it usually grows on a deeper area. It's hard to explain. I've studied ecosystems back when I was fishing a pro bass circuit. I give ecosystems on water bodies, that was my topic. And you know, cabbage is really important, especially, you know, when that starts seeding out, sunfish just love that, and then all the predator fish come right in. I mean, muskies love sitting in cabbage. So now, without the cabbage, they're going to the inside weed lines, believe it or not. They're going shallower, and I've catch a lot of muskies fishing bass during the course of the year. One day I caught 7, and guys are out there throwing 8-ounce baits running around on the weed line, and I go, dude. And they were right next to water milfoil. Well, water milfoil is really good too, but if you put that chemicals in there, it kills that too.
You bet. Well, you know, there's the best thing is we got to be more proactive on this stuff rather than reactive. I mean, I know over in Minnesota, they're really clamped down on, you know, making sure you don't drag any weeds around from one lake to the other. I mean, we're talking that all the time here, and we preach that, and we've got some ordinances and stuff too, but still, it gets most of the time that those weeds and stuff get transported by one boat going from one lake to another.
Yeah, there's zebra mussels is really, really important, you know, that's in our Great Lakes. So any boat that goes up there and comes down here, you know, and then I think it's called a tiny water flea. I mean, that can be devastating too. You know, like, look what Asian carp did. They brought that in to get rid of vegetation, a couple lakes, and that flooded, and like, Asian carp is probably all the way up here into Pool 2 in the Mississippi River now, I think.
I know a lot of people over in northern Minnesota, talking to them, where you've got majority of the lakes over there do have, you know, the zebra mussels in them. The lakes have got extremely clear. I mean, very, very clear. One of the guys was just telling me here a month or so ago, you know, you could see a white disc at 20-some feet down, 27 feet, I believe it was. I mean, you know, that's real clear water. And it's made it harder to catch fish because the fish get a lot spookier. You have to change everything you do out there to catch fish when you have that. And I mentioned earlier, when you get that stuff, those little crusty shells, they're on everywhere. And I've had people tell me you can't really walk on a beach someplace without scraping the bottom of your feet up.
Yeah, when I was first noticed, and, you know, I'm originally from Minnesota, boy, the Minnesota Sea Grant really went crazy in regards to trying to let the public know and you know, drain your boat, you know, you can actually sanitize it. And some lakeshore associations are, you know, like Lake Owen, they have a sanitation station. Spooner Lake has a sanitation station. You know, because it has to be pretty hot, you know, to kill that kind of stuff, but there's got to be ulterior methods than keeping the chemicals out of our lake, because right now, with all the other chemicals that are making into our aquifers, you know, 10 years from now, you won't be able to eat a fish out of there. So why do we want to accelerate that process? Let's try to protect it the best we can. I think all lakeshore associations should be responsible for creating, using all biodegradable products within their household, like I do at my place. It doesn't cost you that much. In fact, laundry soap, it's actually cheaper than buying Tide or something. You know, be conscientious of what you put in your septic system, because that makes it in the lake. There was one lake I went to, I'm not going to mention the lake, but I went up this little feeder creek. The smell was so bad, I just started gagging, and it's like, I couldn't deal with it. But weed harvesters, and then if you take and create a mulch area or find a company to buy it, it makes great garden fertilizer, plant fertilizer. It just got to sit for a while to start to decompose.
It might be a business opportunity for somebody out there to come into, but yeah, I know you've done a tremendous amount of research on this. You come into my office here with just a stack of papers and stuff, but where is somebody going to find some of this information on this stuff if they want to dig into it and see what we're doing?
Well, if you want to look at a study that got it all started and how dangerous forever chemicals can be, you can just search Forever Chemicals, State of Maine. If you want to understand the food supply and the water and stuff, you can go to the EWG, Environmental Working Group. The Sierra Club, they're more worldwide. You know, they're kind of like Save the Oceans with plastic and stuff like that. There's, for the state of Wisconsin, they have the Water Watch nonprofit organization. Back in 2015, they listed that it was 44% of the Wisconsin private wells weren't suitable for drinking. Ken Bradbury through UW, they released to the site on a study they did in the southern part of the state in regards to, you know, 400 and some wells were contaminated, and they found some of those had different types of bacteria in, and they couldn't really understand it, and then, you know, further study had to be done. And then since then, you know, Ken retired. He went public with some stuff after he left his position, but we're not going to get into that today.
Well, a lot of interesting stuff there, Ken. You know, we're kind of running down a full half hour here almost. Anything else you want to put in there as we wrap up here real quick? We talked about a lot of different things and some things that really start thinking about, because we all care about our lakes and our fisheries out there.
Well, I moved up here getting you know, I moved from the concrete jungle and I wanted to come up here to be with nature. I grew up in rural Minnesota, so I really appreciate wildlife and aquaculture and stuff. And so if you really look long term, just because the water looks clear doesn't mean it's safe. So we have to be mindful on keeping chemicals out of our water body. Why? For the health of the people, so it doesn't get in our aquifer and our wells. But mainly, it's for the economics. Fishing is very, very, very important for people coming out of state. For instance, state of Wisconsin sold 1,415,000 licenses last year. Through a course of my year, a lot of them are non-residents. They just want to come up here and catch a couple fish. They want that experience. As an example, I fished a BASS Northern Divisional Tournament on the Illinois River. And Asian carp was in there back time. I think this was in the mid-90s. So I locked through it. I was going to go down to Beardstown because looking at Google Earth, I could see that there's some clear water back here. So I locked through by Chillicothe. And I got to Havana, and I go, holy crap, look at all these buzzards all of a sudden. But it was so bad. I put the hammer down at like 72 miles per hour, holding my breath as long as I could. And I noticed there's thousands and thousands of buzzards. And then when I got further downstream, there's dead buzzards. So there's no buzzards eating the buzzards. I mean, so that was through some industrial discharge that went to the lake and it killed everything. There wasn't even no Asian carp back there. But if you get above it, and there was Asian carp, and boy, they'd be bouncing off your boat, jumping in your boat, skyrocketing over your boat. It was quite an adventure, you know, never ever seen that before. But, and so I went to the next morning, I went to breakfast, and I went to the nearest kind of like older restaurant where I know a lot of the farmers would be. So I started talking about it, and they says, yeah, they were just all sad about it, you know.
Wow. A lot of interesting stuff there, Ken. I want to thank you for taking the time here to come on here. And, you know, so a lot of things that we ought to be thinking about a lot.
Well, another thing is, most important thing, the DNR's, a lot of these guys got a lot of passion, but they don't have the funding. We need more law enforcement people out there. We need more information on, you know, say, for instance, you catch a 25, a big bass in, you know, 25 feet of water or a big walleye, you know, in the fall. Well, you have to know how to fizz it. Otherwise, it's not really going to survive, not unless you're holding your live well for 4 hours. But the DNR needs more funding. You know, I've been following their fiscal budget for the last 5-6 years. They're not even the ballpark to Minnesota. Minnesota, for their fisheries, I think it's like $30 million or more they're putting into their fisheries. They're investing like almost $2 billion into their parks and rec department and their fisheries through the budgeting. And that's just recent. You know, we need to be proactive on legislation for the state of Wisconsin to ensure our fishing is sustainable for our grandkids to fish. Because, you know, if you look at the economic gain of providing an opportunity, you know, the younger generation is going to get involved. But if they see that declining, they're going to find alternative methods so they entertain themselves when they become, you know, 16, 17.
Wow. You know, it's kind of amazing what you're talking, the difference between Minnesota and Wisconsin. It makes me wonder, you know, with all them license sales, what's happening there?
Well, all the money goes into a kind of a... You know, I can't recall the name of it, but every state organization has a kind of a general fund it goes into. You know, and then a certain percentage will go out to parks. Some of them will go to, like, fisheries, and just not enough to go around.
Interesting. Well, you know, Ken, we're out of time for this half hour. It went real long time for the podcast. I want to thank you again for coming on here. Been real interesting information.
Well, thank you for allowing me to express my opinions. You know, I just study it on my own and kind of keep track of things. And, you know, I started, there was three other anglers myself. We started a classic bass in Minnesota. And we started out by a five-page brochure, you know, letting everybody know where tournaments were at. And even back then, I wrote Ken's Environmental Corner. And I have the passion for the outdoors, and I love to catch and release fish, and And I think there should be more people out there and more outspoken. And I just, you know, it's time for me to wake up.
Thanks a lot, Ken.
Thank you.
Well, folks, that about wraps up the podcast for this week. I want to remind everyone out there that if you want more information on the radio show, Wisconsin Northland Outdoor Radio, you can go to WNORadio.com, find out information there. It's also on Spotify and Google Podcasts and a bunch of other places. Anyway, hope everybody's out there is getting ready for open water and getting out on our lakes again. Check out our website and Spotify for fishing reports from the Hayward Lakes area and a lot more with getting ready for that open water and fishing season again. Thanks for listening, folks, and we'll be back with another podcast and more radio shows for you.